She would know what to do. Quite some time passed before Granny settled down in her room. By then, the maids were snoring loudly. I pretended to turn over on my futon in order to steal a glance at Pumpkin, kneeling on the floor not far away. I couldn't see her face well, but I had the impression she was growing drowsy. Originally, I'd planned to wait until she fell asleep, but I had no idea of the time any longer, and besides, Hatsumomo might come home at any moment. I sat up as quietly as I could, thinking that if anyone noticed me, I would simply go to the toilet and come back again. But no one paid any attention. A robe for me to wear on the following morning lay folded on the floor nearby. I took it in my arms and went straight for the stairwell. Outside Mother's door, I stood listening for a while. She didn't usually snore, so I couldn't judge anything from the silence, except that she wasn't talking on the phone or making any other sort of noise. Actually, her room wasn't completely silent because her little dog, Taku, was wheezing in his sleep. The longer I listened, the more his wheezing sounded like someone saying my name. Chiyo, Chiyo. I wasn't prepared to sneak out of the okya until I'd satisfied myself Mother was asleep, so I decided to slide the door open and have a look. If she was awake, I would simply say I thought someone had called me. Like Granny, Mother slept with her lamp on her table illuminated, so when I opened the door a crack and peered in, I could see the parched bottoms of her feet sticking out of the sheets. Taku lay between her feet with his chest rising and falling, making that wheezy noise that sounded so much like my name. I shut her door again and changed my clothes in the upstairs hallway. The only thing I lacked now were shoes, and I never considered running away without them, which ought to give you some idea how much I'd changed since the summer. If Pumpkin hadn't been kneeling in the front entrance hall, I would have taken a pair of the wooden shoes used for walking along the dirt corridor. Instead, I took the shoes reserved for use in the upstairs toilet. They were of a very poor quality, with a single leather thong across the top to hold them in place on the foot. To make matters worse, they were much too big for me, but I had no other option. After closing the trap door silently behind me, I stuffed my sleeping robe under the gravity feed tank and managed to climb up and straddle my legs over the ridge of the roof. I won't pretend I wasn't frightened. The voices of people on the street certainly seemed a long way below me, but I had no time to waste being afraid, for it seemed to me that at any moment one of the maids, or even Auntie or Mother, might pop up through the trapdoor looking for me. I put the shoes onto my hands to keep from dropping them, and began scooting my way along the ridge, which proved to be more difficult than I'd imagined. The roof tiles were so thick, they made almost a small step where they overlapped, and they clanked against one another when I shifted my weight unless I moved very slowly. Every noise I made echoed off the roofs nearby. I took several minutes to cross just to the other side of our okya. The roof of the building next door was a step lower than ours. I climbed down onto it and stopped a moment to look for a path to the street. But despite the moonlight, I could see only a sheet of blackness. The roof was much too high and steep for me to consider sliding down it on a gamble. I wasn't at all sure the next roof would be better, and I began to feel a bit panicky. But I continued along from ridge to ridge until I found myself near the end of the block, looking down on one side into an open courtyard. If I could make my way to the gutter, I could scoot around it until I came to what I thought was probably a bath shed. From the top of the bath shed, I could climb down into the courtyard easily. I didn't relish the thought of dropping into the middle of someone else's house. I had no doubt it was an okya. All the houses along our block were. In all likelihood, someone would be waiting at the front door for the geisha to return and would grab me by the arm as I tried to run out. And what if the front door was locked, just as ours was? I wouldn't even have considered this route if I'd had any other choice, but I thought the path down looked safer than anything I'd seen yet. I sat on the ridge a long while, listening for any clues from the courtyard below. All I could hear was laughter and conversation from the street. I had no idea what I would find in the courtyard when I dropped in, but I decided I'd better make my move before someone in my Okia discovered me gone. If I'd had any idea of the damage I was about to do to my future, I would have spun around on that ridge as fast as I could have and scooted right back where I'd come from. But I knew nothing of what was at stake. I was just a child who thought she was embarking on a great adventure. I swung my leg over so that in a moment I was dangling along the slope of the roof, just barely clinging to the ridge. I realized with some panic that it was much steeper than I'd thought it would be. I tried to scamper back up, but I couldn't do it. With the toilet shoes on my hands, I couldn't grab onto the ridge of the roof at all, but only hook my wrists over it. I knew I had committed myself, for I would never manage to climb back up again, but it seemed to me that the very moment I let go, I would slide down that roof out of control. My mind was racing with these thoughts, but before I'd made the decision to let go of the ridge, it let go of me. At first, I glided down more slowly than I would have expected, which gave me some hope I might stop myself farther down, where the roof curved outward to form the eaves. But then my foot dislodged one of the roof tiles, which slid down with a clattering noise and shattered in the courtyard below. The next thing I knew, I lost my grip on one of the toilet shoes, and it slid right past me. I heard the quiet plop as it landed below, and then a much worse sound. The sound of footsteps coming down a wooden walkway toward the courtyard. Many times I had seen the way flies stood on a wall or ceiling, just as if they were on level ground. Whether they did it by having sticky feet or by not weighing very much, I had no idea. But when I heard the sound of someone walking below, I decided that whatever I did, I would find a way of sticking to that roof just as a fly might do, and I would find it right away. Otherwise, I was going to end up sprawled in that courtyard in another few seconds. I tried digging my toes into the roof, and then my elbows and knees. As a final act of desperation, I did the most foolish thing of all. I slipped the shoe from my other hand and tried to stop myself by pressing my two palms against the roof tiles. My palms must have been dripping with sweat, because instead of slowing down, I began to pick up speed the moment I touched them to the roof. I heard myself skidding with a hissing sound, and then suddenly, the roof was no longer there. For a moment, I heard nothing, only a frightening, empty silence. As I fell through the air, I had time to form one thought clearly in my mind. I pictured a woman stepping into the courtyard, looking down to see the shattered tile on the ground, and then looking up toward the roof in time to see me fall out of the sky right on top of her. But of course, this isn't what happened. I turned as I fell and landed on my side on the ground. I had the sense to bring an arm up to protect my head, but still, I landed so heavily that I knocked myself into a daze. I don't know where the woman was standing, or even if she was in the courtyard at the time I fell out of the sky, but she must have seen me come down off that roof, because as I lay stunned on the ground, I heard her say, "Good heavens, it's raining little girls!" Well, I would have liked to jump to my feet and run out, but I couldn't do it. One whole side of my body felt dipped in pain. Slowly, I became aware of two women kneeling over me. One kept saying something again and again, but I couldn't make it out. They talked between themselves and then picked me up from the moss and sat me on the wooden walkway. I remember only one fragment of their conversation. "I'm telling you she came off the roof, ma'am." "Why on earth was she carrying toilet slippers with her? Did you go up there to use the toilet, little girl? Can you hear me? What a dangerous thing you do! You're lucky you didn't break into pieces when you fell."
"She can't hear you, ma'am. Look at her eyes."
"Of course she can hear me. Say something, little girl." But I couldn't say anything. All I could do was think about how Satsu would be waiting for me opposite the Minamisa Theater, and I would never show up. The maid was sent up the street to knock on doors until she found where I'd come from, while I lay curled up in a ball in a state of shock. I was crying without tears and holding my arm, which hurt terribly, when suddenly I felt myself pulled to my feet and slapped across the face. "Foolish, foolish girl," said a voice. Auntie was standing before me in a rage, and then she pulled me out of that okia and behind her up the street. When we reached our okia, she leaned me up against the wooden door and slapped me again across the face. "Do you know what you've done?" she said to me, but I couldn't answer. "What were you thinking? Well, you've ruined everything for yourself, of all the stupid things. Foolish, foolish girl." I'd never imagined Auntie could be so angry. She dragged me into the courtyard and threw me onto my stomach on the walkway. I began to cry in earnest now, for I knew what was coming. But this time, instead of beating me half-heartedly, as she had done before, Auntie poured a bucket of water over my robe to make the rod sting all the more, and then struck me so hard I couldn't even draw a breath. When she was done beating me, she threw the rod onto the ground and rolled me over onto my back. "You'll never be a geisha now," she cried. "I warned you not to make a mistake like this, and now there's nothing I or anyone else can do to help you." I heard nothing more of what she said because of the terrible screams from farther up the walkway. Granny was giving Pumpkin a beating for not having kept a better eye on me. As it turned out, I'd broken my arm landing as I had in that courtyard. The next morning, a doctor came and took me to a clinic nearby. It was late afternoon already by the time I was brought back to the okia with a plaster cast on my arm. I was still in terrible pain, but Mother called me immediately to her room. For a long while, she sat staring at me, patting Taku with one hand and holding her pipe in her mouth with the other. "Do you know how much I paid for you?" she said to me at last. "No, ma'am," I answered. "But you're going to tell me you paid more than I'm worth." I won't say this was a polite way to respond. In fact, I thought Mother might slap me for it, but I was beyond caring. It seemed to me nothing in the world would ever be right again. Mother clenched her teeth together and gave a few coughs in that strange laugh of hers. "You're right about that," she said. "Half a yen might have been more than you're worth. Well, I had the impression you were clever, but you're not clever enough to know what's good for you." She went back to puffing at her pipe for a while, and then she said, "I paid 75 yen for you, that's what I paid. Then you went and ruined a kimono, and stole a brooch, and now you've broken your arm, so I'll be adding medical expenses to your debts as well. Plus, you have your meals and lessons. And just this morning, I heard from the mistress of the Tatsuyo over in Miyagawa-cho that your older sister has run away. The mistress there still hasn't paid me what she owes. Now she tells me she's not going to do it. I'll add that to your debt as well. But what difference will it make? You already owe more than you'll ever repay." So Satsu had escaped. I'd spent the day wondering, and now I had my answer. I wanted to feel happy for her, but I couldn't. "I suppose you could repay it after 10 or 15 years as a geisha," she went on, "if you happen to be a success. But who would invest another sen in a girl who runs away?" I wasn't sure how to reply to any of this, so I told Mother I was sorry. She'd been talking to me pleasantly enough until then, but after my apology, she put her pipe on the table and stuck out her jaw so much, from anger, I suppose, that she gave me the impression of an animal about to strike. "Sorry, are you? I was a fool to invest so much money in you in the first place. You're probably the most expensive maid in all of Gion. If I could sell off your bones to pay back some of your debts, why, I'd rip them right out of your body." With this, she ordered me out of the room and put her pipe back into her mouth. My lip was trembling when I left, but I held my feelings in, for there on the landing stood Hatsumomo. Mr. Becker was waiting to finish tying her obi while Auntie, with a handkerchief in her hand, stood in front of Hatsumomo, peering into her eyes. "Well, it's all smeared," Auntie said. "There's nothing more I can do. You'll have to finish your little cry and redo your makeup afterward." I knew exactly why Hatsumomo was crying. Her boyfriend had stopped seeing her, now that she'd been barred from bringing him to the Okia. I'd learned this the morning before, and felt certain Hatsumomo was going to blame her troubles on me. I was eager to get down the stairs before she spotted me, but it was already too late. She snatched the handkerchief from Auntie's hand and made a gesture calling me over. I certainly didn't want to go, but I couldn't refuse. "You've got no business with Chio," Auntie said to her. "Just go into your room and finish your makeup." Hatsumomo didn't reply, but drew me into her room and shut the door behind us. "I've spent days trying to decide exactly how I ought to ruin your life," she said to me. "But now, you've tried to run away and done it for me. I don't know whether to feel pleased. I was looking forward to doing it myself." It was very rude of me, but I bowed to Hatsumomo and slid open the door to let myself out without replying. She might have struck me for it, but she only followed me into the hall and said, "If you wonder what it will be like as a maid all your life, just have a talk with Auntie. Already you're like two ends of the same piece of string. She has her broken hip, you have your broken arm. Perhaps one day you'll even look like a man, just the way Auntie does." "There you go, Hatsumomo," Auntie said. "Show us that famous charm of yours." Back when I was a little girl of 5 or 6 and had never so much as thought about Kyoto once in all my life, I knew a little boy named Noboru in our village. I'm sure he was a nice boy, but he had a very unpleasant smell, and I think that's why he was so unpopular. Whenever he spoke, all the other children paid him no more attention than if a bird had chirped or a frog had croaked, and poor Noboru often sat right down on the ground and cried. In the months after my failed escape, I came to understand just what life must have been like for him, because no one spoke to me at all unless it was to give me an order. Mother had always treated me as though I were only a puff of smoke, for she had more important things on her mind, but now all the maids and the cook and Granny did the same. All that bitter cold winter, I wondered what had become of Satsu and of my mother and father. Most nights when I lay on my futon, I was sick with anxiety, and felt a pit inside myself as big and empty as if the whole world were nothing more than a giant hall empty of people. To comfort myself, I closed my eyes and imagined that I was walking along the path beside the sea cliffs in Yoroido. I knew it so well I could picture myself there as vividly as if I really had run away with Satsu and was back at home again. In my mind, I rushed toward our tipsy house, holding Satsu's hand, though I had never held her hand before, knowing that in another few moments we would be reunited with our mother and father. I never did manage to reach the house in these fantasies. Perhaps I was too afraid of what I might find there, and in any case, it was the trip along the path that seemed to comfort me. Then, at some point, I would hear the cough of one of the maids near me, or the embarrassing sound of Granny passing wind with a groan, and in that instant, the smell of the sea air dissolved. The coarse dirt of the path beneath my feet turned into the sheets of my futon once again, and I was left where I'd started with nothing but my own loneliness. When spring came, the cherry trees blossomed in Maruyama Park, and no one in Kyoto seemed to talk about anything else. Hatsumomo was busier than usual during the daytime because of all the blossom viewing parties. I envied her the bustling life I saw her prepare for every afternoon. I'd already begun to give up my hopes of awakening one night to find that Satsu had sneaked into our okia to rescue me, or that in some other way I might hear word of my family in Yoroido. Then one morning, as Mother and Auntie were preparing to take Granny on a picnic, I came down the stairs to find a package on the floor of the front entrance hall. It was a box about as long as my arm, wrapped in heavy paper and tied up with frayed twine. I knew it was none of my business, but since no one was around to see me, I went over to read the name and address in heavy characters on the face. It said, Sakamoto Chiyo, care of Nitta Kayoko, Gion Taminagacho, City of Kyoto, Kyoto Prefecture. I was so astonished that I stood a long while with my hand over my mouth, and I'm sure my eyes were as big around as teacups. The return address beneath a patch of stamps was from Mr. Tanaka. I had no idea what could possibly be in the package, but seeing Mr. Tanaka's name there, you may find it absurd, but I honestly hoped perhaps he'd recognized his mistake in sending me to this terrible place and had mailed me something to set me free from the Okia. I can't imagine any package that might free a little girl from slavery. I had trouble imagining it even then, but I truly believed in my heart that somehow, when that package was opened, my life would be changed forever. Before I could figure out what to do next, Auntie came down the stairs and shooed me away from the box, even though it had my name on it. I would have liked to open it myself, but she called for a knife to cut the twine and then took her time unwrapping the coarse paper. Underneath was a layer of canvas sacking stitched up with heavy fisherman's thread. Sewn to the sacking by its corners was an envelope bearing my name. Auntie cut the envelope free and then tore away the sacking to reveal a dark wooden box. I began to get excited about what I might find inside. But when Auntie took off the lid, I felt myself all at once growing heavy. For there, nestled amid folds of white linen, lay the tiny mortuary tablets that had once stood before the altar in our tipsy house. Two of them, which I had never seen before, looked newer than the others and bore unfamiliar Buddhist names written with characters I couldn't understand. I was afraid even to wonder why Mr. Tanaka had sent them. For the moment, Auntie left the box there on the floor, with the tablets lined up so neatly inside, and took the letter from the envelope to read it. I stood for what seemed a long while, full of my fears, and not daring even to think. Finally, Auntie sighed heavily and led me by the arm into the reception room. My hands were trembling in my lap as I knelt at the table, probably from the force of trying to keep all my terrible thoughts from rising to the surface of my mind. Perhaps it was really a hopeful sign that Mr. Tanaka had sent me the mortuary tablets. Wasn't it possible that my family would be moving to Kyoto, that we would buy a new altar together and set up the tablets before it? Or perhaps Satsu had asked that they be sent to me because she was on her way back. And then Auntie interrupted my thoughts. Chiyo, I'm going to read you something from a man named Tanaka Ichiro. She said it in a voice that was strangely heavy and slow. I don't think I breathed at all while she spread the paper out on the table. Dear Chiyo, two seasons have passed since you left Yoroido, and soon the trees will give birth to a new generation of blossoms. Flowers that grow where old ones have withered serve to remind us that death will one day come to us all. As one who was once an orphaned child himself, this humble person is sorry to have to inform you of the terrible burden you must bear. 6 weeks after you left for your new life in Kyoto, the suffering of your honored mother came to its end, and only a few weeks afterward your honored father departed this world as well. This humble person is deeply sorry for your loss and hopes you will rest assured that the remains of both your honored parents are enshrined in the village cemetery. Services were conducted for them at the Hokoji Temple in Senzuru, and in addition, the women in Yoroido have chanted sutras. This humble person feels confident that both your honored parents have found their places in paradise. The training of an apprentice geisha is an arduous path. However, this humble person is filled with admiration for those who are able to recast their suffering and become great artists. Some years ago, when visiting Gion, it was my honor to view the spring dances and attended a party afterward at a tea house, and the experience has left the deepest impression.
It gives me some measure of satisfaction to know that a safe place in this world has been found for you, Chio, and that you will not be forced to suffer through years of uncertainty. This humble person has been alive long enough to see two generations of children grow up and knows how rare it is for ordinary birds to give birth to a swan. The swan who goes on living in his parents' tree will die. This is why those who are beautiful and talented bear the burden of finding their own way in the world. Your sister, Satsu, came through Yoroido late this past fall, but ran away again at once with the son of Mr. Sugi. Mr. Sugi fervently hopes to see his beloved son again in this lifetime, and asks therefore that you please notify him immediately if you receive word from your sister. Most sincerely yours, Tanaka Ichiro. Long before Auntie had finished reading this letter, the tears had begun to flow out of me, just like water from a pot that boils over. It would have been bad enough to learn that my mother had died, or that my father had died. But to learn in a single moment that both my mother and my father had died and left me, and that my sister too was lost to me forever, at once my mind felt like a broken vase that would not stand. I was lost even within the room around me. You must think me very naive, for having kept alive the hope for so many months that my mother might still be living. But really, I had so few things to hope for. I suppose I would have clutched at anything. Auntie was very kind to me while I tried to find my bearings. Again and again she said to me, "Bear up, Chio, bear up. There's nothing more any of us can do in this world." When I was finally able to speak, I asked Auntie if she would set up the tablets someplace where I wouldn't see them, and pray on my behalf, for it would give me too much pain to do it. But she refused, and told me I should be ashamed even to consider turning my back on my own ancestors. She helped me set the tablets up on a shelf near the base of the stairwell, where I could pray before them every morning. "Never forget them, Chio-chan," she said. "They're all that's left of your childhood." Chapter 9. Around the time of my 65th birthday, a friend sent me an article she'd found somewhere called "The 20 Greatest Geisha of Gion's Past." Or maybe it was the 30 Greatest Geisha, I don't remember. But there I was, on the list with a little paragraph telling some things about me, including that I'd been born in Kyoto, which, of course, I wasn't. I can assure you, I wasn't one of Gion's 20 Greatest Geisha, either. Some people have difficulty telling the difference between something great and something they've simply heard of. In any case, I would have been lucky to end up as nothing more than a bad geisha and an unhappy one, like so many other poor girls, if Mr. Tanaka had never written to tell me that my parents had died and that I would probably never see my sister again. I'm sure you'll recall my saying that the afternoon when I first met Mr. Tanaka was the very best afternoon of my life, and also the very worst. Probably I don't need to explain why it was the worst, but you may be wondering how I could possibly imagine that anything good ever came of it. It's true that up until this time in my life, Mr. Tanaka had brought me nothing but suffering, but he also changed my horizons forever. We lead our lives like water flowing down a hill, going more or less in one direction until we splash into something that forces us to find a new course. If I'd never met Mr. Tanaka, my life would have been a simple stream flowing from our tipsy house to the ocean. Mr. Tanaka changed all that when he sent me out into the world. But being sent out into the world isn't necessarily the same as leaving your home behind you. I'd been in Gion more than 6 months by the time I received Mr. Tanaka's letter, and yet, during that time, I'd never for a moment given up the belief that I would one day find a better life elsewhere, with at least part of the family I'd always known. I was living only half in Gion, the other half of me lived in my dreams of going home. This is why dreams can be such dangerous things. They smolder on like a fire does, and sometimes consume us completely. During the rest of the spring and all of that summer following the letter, I felt like a child lost on a lake in the fog. The days spilled one after another into a muddle. I remember only snippets of things, aside from a constant feeling of misery and fear. One cold evening after winter had come, I sat a long while in the maid's room watching snow falling silently into the Okia's little courtyard. I imagined my father coughing at the lonely table in his lonely house, and my mother so frail upon her futon that her body scarcely sank into the bedding. I stumbled out into the courtyard to try to flee my misery, but of course we can never flee the misery that is within us. Then in early spring, a full year after the terrible news about my family, something happened. It was the following April when the cherry trees were in blossom once again. It may even have been a year to the day since Mr. Tanaka's letter. I was almost 12 by then, and was beginning to look a bit womanly, even though Pumpkin still looked very much like a little girl. I'd grown nearly as tall as I would ever grow. My body would remain thin and knobby like a twig for a year or two more, but my face had already given up its childish softness and was now sharp around the chin and cheekbones, and had broadened in such a way as to give a true almond shape to my eyes. In the past, men had taken no more notice of me on the streets than if I had been a pigeon. Now they were watching me when I passed them. I found it strange to be the object of attention after being ignored for so long. In any case, very early one morning that April, I awoke from a most peculiar dream about a bearded man. His beard was so heavy that his features were a blur to me, as if someone had censored them from the film. He was standing before me saying something I can't remember, and then all at once he slid open the paper screen over a window beside him with a loud clack. I awoke thinking I'd heard a noise in the room. The maids were sighing in their sleep. Pumpkin lay quietly with her round face sagging into the pillow. Everything looked just as it always did, I'm sure, but my feelings were strangely different. I felt as though I were looking at a world that was somehow changed from the one I'd seen the night before, peering out almost through the very window that had opened in my dream. I couldn't possibly have explained what this meant, but I continued thinking about it while I swept the stepping stones in the courtyard that morning, until I began to feel the sort of buzzing in my head that comes from a thought circling and circling with nowhere to go, just like a bee in a jar. Soon I put down the broom and went to sit in the dirt corridor, where the cool air from beneath the foundation of the main house drifted soothingly over my back. And then something came to mind that I hadn't thought about since my very first week in Kyoto. Only a day or two after being separated from my sister, I had been sent to wash some rags one afternoon when a moth came fluttering down from the sky onto my arm. I flicked it off, expecting that it would fly away, but instead it sailed like a pebble across the courtyard and lay there upon the ground. I didn't know if it had fallen from the sky already dead, or if I had killed it, but its little insect death touched me. I admired the lovely pattern on its wings, and then wrapped it in one of the rags I was washing, and hid it away beneath the foundation of the house. I hadn't thought about this moth since then, but the moment it came to mind, I got to my knees and looked under the house until I found it. So many things in my life had changed, even the way I looked, but when I unwrapped the moth from its funeral shroud, it was the same startlingly lovely creature as on the day I had entombed it. It seemed to be wearing a robe in subdued grays and browns, like Mother wore when she went to her mahjong games at night. Everything about it seemed beautiful and perfect, and so utterly unchanged. If only one thing in my life had been the same as during that first week in Kyoto. As I thought of this, my mind began to swirl like a hurricane. It struck me that we, the moth and I, were two opposite extremes. My existence was as unstable as a stream, changing in every way, but the moth was like a piece of stone, changing not at all. While thinking this thought, I reached out a finger to feel the moth's velvety surface, but when I brushed it with my fingertip, it turned all at once into a pile of ash without even a sound, without even a moment in which I could see it crumbling. I was so astonished I let out a cry. The swirling in my mind stopped. I felt as if I had stepped into the eye of a storm. I let the tiny shroud and its pile of ashes flutter to the ground. And now I understood the thing that had puzzled me all morning. The stale air had washed away. The past was gone. My mother and father were dead, and I could do nothing to change it. But I suppose that for the past year, I'd been dead in a way, too. And my sister, yes, she was gone. But I wasn't gone. I'm not sure this will make sense to you, but I felt as though I'd turned around to look in a different direction, so that I no longer faced backward toward the past, but forward toward the future. And now the question confronting me was this: what would that future be? The moment this question formed in my mind, I knew with as much certainty as I'd ever known anything that sometime during that day I would receive a sign. This was why the bearded man had opened the window in my dream. He was saying to me, "Watch for the thing that will show itself to you, because that thing, when you find it, will be your future." I had no time for another thought before Auntie called out to me, "Chio, come here." Well, I walked up that dirt corridor as though I were in a trance. It wouldn't have surprised me if Auntie had said, "You want to know about your future? All right, listen closely." But instead, she just held out two hair ornaments on a square of white silk. "Take these," she said to me. "Heaven knows what Hatsumomo was up to last night. She came back to the Okia wearing another girl's ornaments. She must have drunk more than her usual amount of sake. Go find her at the school. Ask whose they are and return them." When I took the ornaments, Auntie gave me a piece of paper with a number of other errands written on it as well, and told me to come back to the Okia as soon as I had done them all. Wearing someone else's hair ornaments home at night may not sound so peculiar, but really it's about the same thing as coming home in someone else's underwear. Geisha don't wash their hair every day, you see, because of their fancy hairstyles. So a hair ornament is a very intimate article. Auntie didn't even want to touch the things, which is why she was holding them on a square of silk. She wrapped them up to give them to me so that they looked just like the bundled-up moth I'd been holding only a few minutes earlier. Of course, a sign doesn't mean anything unless you know how to interpret it. I stood there, staring at the silk bundle in Auntie's hand, until she said, "Take it, for heaven's sake!" Later, on my way to the school, I unfolded it to have another look at the ornaments. One was a black lacquer comb, shaped like the setting sun, with a design of flowers in gold around the outside. The other was a stick of blonde wood with two pearls at the end, holding in place a tiny amber sphere. I waited outside the school building until I heard the dawn of the bell signaling the end of classes. Soon, girls in their blue and white robes came pouring out. Hatsumomo spotted me even before I spotted her, and came toward me with another geisha. You may wonder why she was at the school at all, since she was already an accomplished dancer and certainly knew everything she needed to know about being a geisha, but even the most renowned geisha continued to take advanced lessons in dance throughout their careers, some of them even into their 50s and 60s. "Why, look," Hatsumomo said to her friend. "I think it must be a weed. Look how tall it is." This was her way of ridiculing me for having grown a finger's width taller than her. "Auntie has sent me here, ma'am," I said, "to find out whose hair ornaments you stole last night." Hatsumomo's smile faded. She snatched the little bundle from my hand and opened it. "Why, these aren't mine," she said. "Where did you get them?" "Oh, Hatsumomo-san," said the other geisha, "don't you remember? You and Kanako took out your hair ornaments while the two of you were playing that foolish game with Judge Uwazumi. Kanako must have gone home with your hair ornaments, and you went home with hers." "How disgusting," said Hatsumomo. "When do you think Kanako last washed her hair? Anyway, her Okia is right next to yours. Take them for me, would you? Tell her I'll come to fetch mine later, and she better not try to keep them." The other geisha took the hair ornaments and left.
"Oh, don't go, little Chiyo," Hatsumomo said to me. "There's something I want to show you. It's that young girl over there, the one walking through the gate. Her name is Ichikimi."
I looked at Ichikimi, but Hatsumomo didn't seem to have any more to say about her.
"I don't know her," I said.
"No, of course not. She's nothing special, a bit stupid, and as awkward as a cripple. But I just thought you'd find it interesting that she's going to be a geisha, and you never will."
I don't think Hatsumomo could have found anything crueler to say to me. For a year and a half now, I'd been condemned to the drudgery of a maid. I felt my life stretching out before me like a long path leading nowhere. I won't say I wanted to become a geisha, but I certainly didn't want to remain a maid. I stood in the garden of the school a long while, watching the young girls my age chat with one another as they streamed past. They may only have been heading back for lunch, but to me they were going from one important thing to another with lives of purpose, while I, on the other hand, would go back to nothing more glamorous than scrubbing the stones in the courtyard. When the garden emptied out, I stood worrying that perhaps this was the sign I'd waited for, that other young girls in Gion would move ahead in their lives and leave me behind. This thought gave me such a fright, I couldn't stay alone in the garden any longer. I walked down to Shizhou Avenue and turned toward the Kamo River. Giant banners on the Minamisa Theater announced the performance of a kabuki play that afternoon entitled Shibaraku, which is one of our most famous plays, though I knew nothing about kabuki at that time. Crowds streamed up the steps into the theater. Among the men in their dark Western-style suits or kimono, several geisha stood out in brilliant coloring, just like autumn leaves on the murky waters of a river. Here again, I saw life in all its noisy excitement passing me by. I hurried away from the avenue, down a side street leading along the Shirakawa stream, but even there, men and geisha were rushing along in their lives so full of purpose. To shut out the pain of this thought, I turned toward the Shirakawa, but cruelly, even its waters glided along with purpose, toward the Kamo River, and from there to Osaka Bay and the inland sea. It seemed the same message waited for me everywhere. I threw myself onto the little stone wall at the edge of the stream and wept. I was an abandoned island in the midst of the ocean, with no past, to be sure, but no future either. Soon I felt myself coming to a point where I thought no human voice could reach me, until I heard a man's voice say this, "Why, it's too pretty a day to be so unhappy." Ordinarily, a man on the streets of Gion wouldn't notice a girl like me, particularly while I was making a fool of myself by crying. If he did notice me, he certainly wouldn't speak to me, unless it was to order me out of his way or some such thing. Yet not only had this man bothered to speak to me, he'd actually spoken kindly. He addressed me in a way that suggested I might be a young woman of standing, the daughter of a good friend, perhaps. For a flicker of a moment, I imagined a world completely different from the one I'd always known, a world in which I was treated with fairness, even kindness, a world in which fathers didn't sell their daughters. The noise and hubbub of so many people living their lives of purpose around me seemed to stop, or at least I ceased to be aware of it, and when I raised myself to look at the man who'd spoken, I had a feeling of leaving my misery behind me there on the stone wall. I'll be happy to describe him for you, but I can think of only one way to do it, by telling you about a certain tree that stood at the edge of the sea cliffs in Yoroido. This tree was as smooth as driftwood because of the wind, and when I was a little girl of 4 or 5, I found a man's face on it one day. That is to say, I found a smooth patch as broad as a plate, with 2 sharp bumps at the outside edge for cheekbones. They cast shadows, suggesting eye sockets, and beneath the shadows rose a gentle bump of a nose. The whole face tipped a bit to one side, gazing at me quizzically. It looked to me like a man with as much certainty about his place in this world as a tree has. Something about it was so meditative, I imagined I'd found the face of a Buddha. The man who'd addressed me there on the street had this same kind of broad, calm face, and what was more, his features were so smooth and serene, I had the feeling he'd go on standing there calmly until I wasn't unhappy any longer. He was probably about 45 years old, with gray hair combed straight back from his forehead, but I couldn't look at him for long. He seemed so elegant to me that I blushed and looked away. Two younger men stood at one side of him. A geisha stood to the other. I heard the geisha say to him quietly, "Why, she's only a maid. Probably she stubbed her toe while running an errand. I'm sure someone will come along to help her soon."
"I wish I had your faith in people, Izuku-san," said the man.
"The show will be starting in only a moment. Really, Chairman, I don't think you should waste any more time." While running errands in Gion, I'd often heard men addressed by titles like Department Head or occasionally Vice President, but only rarely had I heard the title Chairman. Usually, the men addressed as Chairman had bald heads and frowns and swaggered down the street with groups of junior executives scurrying behind. This man before me was so different from the usual chairman that even though I was only a little girl with limited experience of the world, I knew his company couldn't be a terribly important one. A man with an important company wouldn't have stopped to talk to me.
"You're trying to tell me it's a waste of time to stay here and help her?" said the chairman.
"Oh, no," the geisha said. "It's more a matter of having no time to waste. We may be late for the first scene already."
"Now, Izuku-san, surely at some time you yourself have been in the same state this little girl is in. You can't pretend the life of a geisha is always simple. I should think you, of all people..."
"I've been in the state she's in? Chairman, do you mean making a public spectacle of myself?" At this, the chairman turned to the two younger men and asked that they take Izuku ahead to the theater. They bowed and went on their way, while the chairman remained behind. He looked at me a long while, though I didn't dare to look back at him. At length, I said, "Please, sir, what she says is true. I'm only a foolish girl. Please don't make yourself late on my account."
"Stand up a moment," he told me.
I didn't dare disobey him, though I had no idea what he wanted. As it turned out, all he did was take a handkerchief from his pocket to wipe away the grit that had stuck to my face from the top of the stone wall. Standing so close before him, I could smell the odor of talc on his smooth skin, which made me recall the day when the Emperor Taisho's nephew had come to our little fishing village. He'd done nothing more than step out of his car and walk to the inlet and back, nodding to the crowds that knelt before him, wearing a Western-style business suit, the first I'd ever seen, for I peeked at him, even though I wasn't supposed to. I remember, too, that his mustache was carefully groomed, unlike the hair on the faces of the men in our village, which grew untended like weeds along a path. No one of any importance had ever been in our village before that day. I think we all felt touched by nobility and greatness. Occasionally in life, we come upon things we can't understand because we have never seen anything similar. The Emperor's nephew certainly struck me that way, and so did the chairman. When he had wiped away the grit and tears from my face, he tipped my head up.
"Here you are, a beautiful girl with nothing on earth to be ashamed of," he said, "and yet you're afraid to look at me. Someone has been cruel to you, or perhaps life has been cruel."
"I don't know, sir," I said, though of course I knew perfectly well.
"We none of us find as much kindness in this world as we should," he told me, and he narrowed his eyes a moment, as if to say I should think seriously about what he just said.
I wanted more than anything to see the smooth skin of his face once more, with its broad brow and the eyelids like sheets of marble over his gentle eyes. But there was such a gulf in social standing between us. I did finally let my eyes flick upward, though I blushed and looked away so quickly that he may never have known I met his gaze. But how can I describe what I saw in that instant? He was looking at me as a musician might look at his instrument just before he begins to play, with understanding and mastery. I felt that he could see into me
as though I were a part of him. How I would have loved to be the instrument he played. In a moment, he reached into his pocket and brought something out.
"Do you like sweet plum or cherry?" he said.
"Sir, do you mean to eat?"
"I passed a vendor a moment ago, selling shaved ice with syrup in it. I never tasted one until I was an adult, but I'd have liked them as a child. Take this coin and buy one. Take my handkerchief, too, so you can wipe your face afterward," he said, and with this he pressed the coin into the center of the handkerchief, wrapped it into a bundle, and held it out to me. From the moment the chairman had first spoken to me, I'd forgotten that I was watching for a sign about my future. But when I saw the bundle he held in his hand, it looked so much like the shrouded moth, I knew I'd come upon the sign at last. I took the bundle and bowed low to thank him, and tried to tell him how grateful I was, though I'm sure my words carried none of the fullness of my feelings. I wasn't thanking him for the coin, or even for the trouble he'd taken in stopping to help me. I was thanking him for, well, for something I'm not sure I can explain even now. For showing me that something besides cruelty could be found in the world, I suppose. I watched him walk away with sickness in my heart, though it was a pleasing kind of sickness, if such a thing exists. I mean to say that if you have experienced an evening more exciting than any in your life, you're sad to see it end, and yet you still feel grateful that it happened. In that brief encounter with the chairman, I had changed from a lost girl facing a lifetime of emptiness to a girl with purpose in her life. Perhaps it seems odd that a casual meeting on the street could have brought about such change, but sometimes life is like that, isn't it? And I really do think if you'd been there to see what I saw and feel what I felt, the same might have happened to you. When the chairman had disappeared from sight, I rushed up the street to search for the shaved ice vendor. The day wasn't especially hot, and I didn't care for shaved ice, but eating it would make my encounter with the chairman linger. So I bought a paper cone of shaved ice with cherry syrup on it, and went to sit again on the same stone wall. The taste of the syrup seemed startling and complex, I think only because my senses were so heightened. If I were a geisha, like the one named Izuko, I thought, a man like the chairman might spend time with me. I'd never imagined myself envying a geisha. I'd been brought to Kyoto for the purpose of becoming one, of course, but up until now, I'd have run away in an instant if I could have. Now I understood the thing I'd overlooked. The point wasn't to become a geisha, but to be one. To become a geisha, well, that was hardly a purpose in life, but to be a geisha, I could see it now as a stepping stone to something else. If I was right about the chairman's age, he was probably no more than 45. Plenty of geisha had achieved tremendous success by the age of 20. The geisha Izuko was probably no more than 25 herself. I was still a child, nearly 12, but in another 12 years I'd be in my 20s. And what of the chairman? He would be no older by that time than Mr. Tanaka was already. The coin the chairman had given me was far more than I'd needed for a simple cone of shaved ice. I held in my hand the change from the vendor, 3 coins of different sizes. At first I thought of keeping them forever, but now I realized they could serve a far more important purpose. I rushed to Shizuo Avenue and ran all the way to its end at the eastern edge of Gion, where the Gion Shrine stood. I climbed the steps but felt too intimidated to walk beneath the great 2-story entrance gate with its gabled roof, and walked around it instead. Across the gravel courtyard and up another flight of steps, I passed through the Torii gate to the shrine itself. There, I threw the coins into the offertory box, coins that might have been enough to take me away from Gion, and announced my presence to the gods by clapping 3 times and bowing. With my eyes squeezed tightly shut and my hands together, I prayed that they permit me to become a geisha somehow. I would suffer through any training, bear up under any hardship, for a chance to attract the notice of a man like the chairman again. When I opened my eyes,
I could still hear the traffic on Higashioji Avenue. The trees hissed in a gust of wind just as they had a moment earlier. Nothing had changed. As to whether the gods had heard me, I had no way of knowing. I could do nothing but tuck the chairman's handkerchief inside my robe and carry it with me back to the Okya. Chapter 10. One morning, quite some months later, while we were putting away the row underrobes, the ones made of lightweight silk gauze for hot weather, and bringing out the hito underrobes instead, the ones with no lining used in September, I came upon a smell in the entryway so horrible that I dropped the armload of robes I was carrying. The smell was coming from Granny's room. I ran upstairs to fetch Auntie, because I knew at once that something must be terribly wrong. Auntie hobbled down the stairs as quickly as she could and went in to find Granny dead on the floor. And she had died in a most peculiar manner. Granny had the only electric space heater in our Okya. She used it every single night except during the summer. Now that the month of September had begun and we were putting away the summer weight underrobes, Granny had begun to use her heater again. That doesn't mean the weather was necessarily cool. We changed the weight of our clothing by the calendar, not by the actual temperature outdoors, and Granny used her heater just the same way. She was unreasonably attached to it, probably because she'd spent so many nights of her life suffering miserably from the cold. Granny's usual routine in the morning was to wrap the cord around the heater before pushing it back against the wall. Over time, the hot metal burned all the way through the cord, so that the wire finally came into contact with it, and the whole thing became electrified. The police said that when Granny touched it that morning, she must have been immobilized at once, maybe even killed instantly. When she slid down to the floor, she ended up with her face pressed against the hot metal surface. This was what caused the horrible smell. Happily, I didn't see her after she died, except for her legs, which were visible from the doorway and looked like slender tree limbs wrapped in wrinkled silk. For a week or two after Granny died, we were as busy as you can imagine, not only with cleaning the house thoroughly, because in Shinto, death is the most impure of all things that can happen, but with preparing the house by setting out candles, trays with meal offerings, lanterns at the entrance, tea stands, trays for money that visitors brought, and so on. We were so busy that one evening the cook became ill and a doctor was summoned. It turned out her only problem was that she'd slept no more than 2 hours the night before, hadn't sat down all day, and had eaten only a single bowl of clear soup. I was surprised, too, to see Mother spending money almost unrestrainedly, making plans for sutras to be chanted on Granny's behalf at the Chionin Temple, purchasing lotus bud arrangements from the undertaker, all of it right in the midst of the Great Depression. I wondered at first if her behavior was a testament to how deeply she felt about Granny, but later I realized what it really meant. Practically all of Gion would come tramping through our Okya to pay respects to Granny and would attend the funeral at the temple later in the week. Mother had to put on the proper kind of show. For a few days, all of Gion did indeed come through our Okya, or so it seemed, and we had to feed tea and sweets to all of them. Mother and Auntie received the mistresses of the various tea houses and Okya, as well as a number of maids who were acquainted with Granny. Also shopkeepers, wig-makers, and hairdressers, most of whom were men, and, of course, dozens and dozens of geisha. The older geisha knew Granny from her working days, but the younger ones had never even heard of her. They came out of respect for Mother, or, in some cases, because they had a relationship of one kind or another with Hatsumomo. My job during this busy period was to show visitors into the reception room, where Mother and Auntie were waiting for them. It was a distance of only a few steps, but the visitors couldn't very well show themselves in, and besides, I had to keep track of which faces belonged to which shoes, for it was my job to take the shoes to the maid's room to keep the entryway from being too cluttered, and then bring them back again at the proper moment. I had trouble with this at first. I couldn't peer right into the eyes of our visitors without seeming rude, but a simple glimpse of their faces wasn't enough for me to remember them. Very soon, I learned to look closely at the kimono they wore. On about the second or third afternoon, the door rolled open, and in came a kimono that at once struck me as the loveliest I'd seen any of our visitors wear. It was somber because of the occasion, a simple black robe bearing a crest, but its pattern of green and gold grasses sweeping around the